Welcome to the 75th annual San Antonio Convention of International Alcoholics Anonymous. My name's Richard, and I'm an alcoholic. I guess that's a good way to start. I'm privileged to chair this meeting for us this morning, and I'd like to introduce our speakers before we get started. It'd be Annie C. from Florida. Karen K., Saskatchewan, Canada. And Renee H. from Maryland. What a great crowd. I guess the rain never stopped a party, huh? It didn't for me. My wife and I drove in from Nevada, and it kept getting darker and cloudier and rainier, and we just kept going. Nothing changes. Let's start our meeting with a few moments of silence, followed by the Serenity Prayer. I will say that my sobriety date is January 4th, 1983. I stumbled into Alcoholics Anonymous, not knowing I was an alcoholic, just knowing that my life was absolutely flying apart. I'd reached another one of those low ebbs in my life, and where the family unit had flown apart one more time, and it had happened a number of times. And I was a single parent one more time with a 10-year-old girl and a 13-year-old boy. And I had no illusions that I had a problem. I just didn't know what my problem was. I know I'd been a lousy father and lousy husband. And the pride that a man has, my ability to make an income had gone slowly down and down and down. And I was pumping gas at the Chevron station in a little town called Searchlight, Nevada. Now, for a drinker, that's heaven. There was a two-bar town. There were dirt parking lots. And we'd, fill those coolers with beer and keep running, But my life inside kept emptying and emptying. And alcohol did exactly what it should do for an alcoholic. It stripped me of every loving thing that I'd ever had in my life. My dignity, my self-esteem. And I just couldn't handle me anymore. And I didn't know what to do. I had a boss at the Chevron station who would start his afternoon with a big glass of Canadian Mist. And he didn't mind if we kept our beer under the counter. I mean, that was the kind of loose life it was. And it was fine with me at the time. And I took him to the airport in Las Vegas. He was going back to Canada to visit his sister. And we drank our way down the highway, back down to the strip on Las Vegas, and went into one of the big casinos down there, Circus, I think it was, and barred up at the sports bar and finished off the day. And at about 10 o'clock that night, I poured myself into my vehicle and started back the 60 miles towards Searchlight. And I stopped in Henderson, about 20 miles outside of town, in a mobile home where the lady who would have been my mother-in-law had her daughter not escaped about three months earlier. I stopped at her home and talked to Peg. And like I say, it all came unglued. And I'm just sitting there crying my eyes out, not knowing what's wrong or why I failed one more time. And she had a brother who was a pharmacist. And he got sober. And she'd spent a lot of time talking to him. And she knew about Alcoholics Anonymous, just a friend of AA. And she said, well, maybe you have a problem with alcohol. I said, maybe. I don't know. Having a couple beers was just a way of saying, let's start drinking. I have no clue when I gave up going to sleep and come waking up and gave it up for passing out and coming to. It just, it happens, right? And you drink with people that drink like that. So it almost looks normal. About a week later, that gal that had moved out in a fit of good taste, she said, my mother has this card for you. And on it was a bunch of numbers and some times and some addresses. And I couldn't make much of it. In the middle of it, there was a guy's name, Julian, and a phone number. It took me about a week to get the courage to call that number. Now, he's 40 miles away, back up in a place called Boulder City. And there's no meetings in Searchlight. Can you get here? I go, yeah, I think so. And so I made my first meeting in January of 1983 in Boulder City. And I went home not knowing what it was about. I did not go home happy, joyous, and free. I did not feel like I had hope. But I went home with a little bit of literature. And he said, I'm going to another meeting tomorrow night. If you can make it up here, I'll take you. So I did, and I went. And it just happened to be a big club called the Triangle Club. Not that that's important, but in that Triangle Club, there was probably 80 people laughing, having a good time, handshakes, hugs. And I went away from that second meeting wanting what you had. I had no clue what you had. I just knew that you were doing a lot better than I was doing. And it was that attraction. I wanted what you had. And AA had done what it was supposed to do. It caught me at that low ebb, you know, where I just run out of hip, slick, and cool. I'd run out of one more clever idea. And I got to sit there, you know, and my stuff and all the junk that I had created. And until about 6 months later in those meetings, I took home a little thing called hope. That maybe this would work for me. And I've been with you ever since. It's a wee program. I love looking out at this crowd. It's a wee program. If I could have sent off to New York, got a little literature and got well, you'd have never seen me. I'm an isolator, you know? But it's a wee program, and I've been coming back ever since. With that, I'm going to ask for our first speaker, Annie. And she has 20 minutes, and I told these folks now, if they don't get sober within the first 18 minutes, why? Annie, from Florida.
Good morning, everybody. How are we doing here in San Antonio? This is definitely, as our big book says, an experience we must not miss. My name is Annie, and I am an alcoholic. My home group is the Vero Beach Step In Traditions group of Alcoholics Anonymous that meets in Vero Beach, Florida. And my sobriety date is January 11th, 1991. And if you're ever in Vero Beach, please stop in and see us. We meet on Wednesday and Fridays at the Salvation Army. And we'd love to welcome you. When I received the lovingly invitation from our General Service Office to speak on this topic, which is courage to change, I thought, oh, okay. First, I was like, oh my God, I'm not good enough. You know, why are they inviting me? And then after I got past that, I decided, courage to change. What does that say to me? To me, that reminds me of the steps, what it took for me to come into Alcoholics Anonymous, and the things that I needed to do if I was to continue to live on this earth. And for me, I decided, let me go to the dictionary and look up two very important words, courage and change. And Webster says that courage is a quality or state of mind enabling one to face danger or hardship with confidence and resolution. And that was something I did not have when I got here. I crawled into these rooms. I was pushed into these rooms by the judge. And I certainly had no courage. I just knew that if I kept on drinking, my life would probably end. And I didn't know how to change. I didn't know how to put the drink down because I craved it all the time. I didn't know how to stop getting those DUIs that I kept getting. I didn't know how to stop having blackouts. And I didn't realize that all of this was related to my drinking. I thought it was just being in the wrong place at the wrong time, not eating properly, the things that we hear all the time. And then I looked up the word change. And then change is to undergo a transformation, to make different. And that was something I yearned for. I wanted to make things different. I wanted to change somehow. But like I said, I didn't know how. Well, there in our next room happens to be the corrections meeting. And for me, there's no coincidences in my life any longer. Because I came in through, as you know, the court system. And looking back at it, it was the best thing that could have happened to me. You know, was to come in through someone that saw where my life was headed, because I couldn't see that. I was so caught up in the denial, and I was so caught up in what was going on within my little world, which consisted of going to work at the hospital, getting out of work, having just enough time to change out of my scrubs and go to the bar for happy hour, and swearing that I wasn't going to stay there all night. And realizing when I looked at my watch the next time, it was 2, 3, 4 in the morning, and having to be back at work in a couple of hours. And I hope that there isn't anyone here that's ever been in a hospital in Florida, because I'm sorry if I got you any further sick. For me, the disease concept was very, very critical in how I was to recover. I didn't realize it was a disease. I thought it was people, places, and things. A couple of things that had happened. For me, like I said, I blacked out and I drank and I drove. And one of my DUIs, of which I had quite a few, the police officer had to follow me for a number of miles before I actually had to stop at the railroad tracks in Florida in order to arrest me for a DUI, because I just focused straight on the road. I couldn't see what was to the left of me, couldn't see what was to the right of me. I just stayed straight ahead, because if I did look any other way, the car would just go that way. I can remember being in a blackout so bad that I came to and I was in a jail cell. And for anyone that's gone through these blackouts, you understand exactly where we came from. I was sentenced to either 5 years in prison or going to AA meetings for 2 consecutive years and having papers signed and all of that stuff. And, Mama didn't raise a dumb girl. I chose, I could, if I stay home, and be on this house arrest thing, I can still go to work and I can still have some sort of freedom. Not exactly freedom, but I thought I would have much more freedom than if I was in jail. So I chose the house arrest. And my very first meeting I went to was in Broward County. I proceeded to go to their 5:30 happy hour meeting. And then after that, I proceeded to go to happy hour. I did that for probably another 9 months until I got my last and final DUI. Because I certainly don't want to go back there ever, ever again. And so this time the judge was not exactly thrilled. I did, get into a little bit more trouble. I had some more consequences added to that list of mandatory meetings and things like that. And I was just beat up so much. When I said I crawled in here, I could not look myself in the mirror and feel okay about myself. I could not look in the eyes of my parents and my family and see the destruction that I was causing and feel okay with myself. I felt no bigger than an inchworm, and I felt horrible. I had completely lost my self-respect. I had lost my self-esteem, and I didn't know where to turn to for help. And luckily, this judge knew about Alcoholics Anonymous, and the probation office knew about Alcoholics Anonymous, and they sent me here. And at that point, I had that gift of desperation, and I was very willing, and I proceeded to start my journey. And one of the first couple of meetings that I had gone to, I didn't really hear a whole lot. I just went, and I sat in the rooms, and I did pick up my white chip, and I can hear people saying, there's one thing you have to change, and that's everything. And I went, oh, God. And I didn't know what to do. And then they talked about a sponsor, and I didn't understand what a sponsor was. And I asked one woman one night, what is this sponsor thing? And I went up to her because she shared something in a meeting one night that I kind of understood, and it made sense to me. She got DUIs on mopeds in college. I got them in cars. It made sense to me at the time. It shows you where I was at. So this woman eventually became my sponsor, and she said, what we have to change is people, places, and things. And we have to get a God of our understanding. And when she said that, the hair on the back of my neck kind of stood up a little, and G-O-D, God, group of drunks, none of that was a part of my life. I had abandoned my God. I had some old family tapes, and, God was just not going to be good to Annie, and that was what I grew up with. I didn't realize that I could also change my perception, change my higher power. And, I proceeded to work the steps with this sponsor. She made me see that when I got into trouble, alcohol was there. Alcohol was involved. When I didn't drink, I didn't get into trouble. So it was a series of what I call my 1 and 1's equal 3. And so we would do all of these different, questions and answers. And we got to the third step. And this took some time. And one of my consequences was having to go back to jail during sobriety. And it all surfaced around my 90 days and around my third step. And we had done my third step. She had me write down all the qualities that I had wanted in a best friend. You know, and I wrote down all these various things, and we got together, and she was a wonderful, wonderful woman. She would come over to my house, or we would have to meet at a meeting, because I'm on this house arrest, and I can't go anywhere except to work in meetings. And, you know, I wrote this down, and we shared about it, and she shared with me what some of her concepts and ideas were. And she said, Annie, you know, this is a program of change, and if you don't change, you could die. And you need this step in order to survive. And she said, at least I did. And I think I did. I really, truly believe that if I did not change my higher power's perception, that I was not going to get it. And I wanted to stay sober. I had experienced a few months of sobriety, and I wanted to stay sober. My life was starting to change. I got that list out, and I looked, and I said, okay. And I wrote it across it, higher power. You know, and my journey of freedom began at that point. I said, how do I go? What do I do from here? You know, and she said, you pray every day to that higher power. And that was very, very difficult for me because I had to keep that sheet with all those new qualities of my higher power with me in the beginning. Because just like that evil drink man that sits on the back of my shoulder once in a while, that evil God that I grew up with, okay, just entered the room. However, with all of your help, we are all stronger than that. And, thank you. And, okay, back on track now. You know, I prayed to this God of my understanding, and I would just say, please help me, God. Help me get through another day. And what I didn't realize was that that was where the courage to continue on, to change my life with your help and with your experience, strength, and hope, to face some of these things that I'm going to face. You know, my fourth step, you know, tremendous amount of courage. You know, and a tremendous, tremendous amount of prayer. My sponsor instilled in me that you just take God with you wherever you go and with every step of this program that you take. And, you know, sometimes quickly, sometimes slowly, and things get better before, or get worse before they get better. And, you know, with her help and with the help of people in the rooms, I was able to take these steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. And, you know, start a journey towards freedom. You know, through the steps, my self-esteem has come back. My self-respect has come back. I have a new God in my life today. One that is very, very loving and caring and nurtures me when I'm afraid or when I have fear creeping into my life, like receiving a letter to speak at the International Convention. You know, to go out and to learn new things and do new things and meet people and interact with people. You know, when I drank, I was a loner. I didn't want you near me because then you'd see how much I drank. And then you'd question me. And you know, today I have people and friends everywhere that are my friends. And it's because of this fellowship. I was taught that, you know, there are three legacies in Alcoholics Anonymous: recovery, unity, and service. And me participating in meetings is not only good for my recovery, but it's a tremendous help for our unity and our service of our three legacies. And you never know when a newcomer is going to show up that needs our help. I can remember that those first few months that I was there, and I would be sitting in the meeting room, you know, just not knowing, okay, how am I going to get through this day and get through all this stuff that I have to get through with, you know, steps and work and court and life. And a newcomer would walk in and say, I'm here for my first meeting, you know, what do I do? I said, here, sit down, have a cup of coffee, you know, let's talk. You know, I can remember that many, many a day, know, I wanted to go out and join you guys in the fellowship. And I couldn't because of my situation for the first couple of years. But you know what? The discipline and what I learned on that was that if I didn't have to be on that house arrest for 2 years, I was still at times so arrogant, and I'll show you, and I knew better than the court system, and I didn't think maybe I'm really not an alcoholic, you know, that it kept me here. You know, the judge saw, and the probation officers, they all saw that I needed to stay here. And somewhere in that first, you know, 6 months, something definitely, the switch flipped for me. And it was like, wow, this is a great place to be. You know, nobody wants anything. Nobody's asking me to buy them anything. You know, it was wonderful. You know, there was love and caring, and nobody cared if I was having a good day or a bad day. They just said, keep coming back. You know, nobody wanted me to, you know, keep coming back into their lives before Alcoholics Anonymous. After I got off this house arrest deal, I was taught to get involved in this program, that if I stuck around in the middle, I would easily, you know, be able to stay sober and possibly not fall off of the edge. So I got involved in my home group, which I'm still involved in my home group to this day, and I began to travel our journey of general service. I came back from going to the restroom one night, and I was the GSR. I stood at our district meeting. I know how terrible it was for me in jail. I didn't have meetings to go to, so I began to write back and forth to women in the jail, and it was very rewarding, you know. And I didn't realize that I was really starting service. My sponsor knew, but she didn't tell me. And then I really began to like it. And I would see people come back from these quarterly area assembly meetings, and they were happy and they were laughing, and I wanted what they had. You know, I wanted that. I didn't laugh so much when I was drinking. I wanted to laugh and I wanted to live. And, you know, I started off, you know, like I say, as a GSR and doing corrections work, and then I became a DCM, where I had the privilege of you know, sharing what I learned with others. And, you know, through this wonderful, wonderful opportunity of getting sober, but having to get drunk and get beaten up in order to get here, I was able to change my life with the courage of asking my higher power for help every day. And, you know, I am always so reminded of page 164, you know, A Vision for You. I just love that chapter. And it does bring so much tremendous amount of hope. It takes a lot of courage, I think, for all of us to come into these rooms and to begin to change our lives. But we can each do it, you know, and that with that third step. But we have to be beaten to almost the grave before, you know, that could happen. At least it was for me. So I am so grateful that I was beaten. I'm grateful that my higher power dragged me up and has given me the courage to ask for help, which is something I was not able to do. And I'm grateful that I've had this opportunity to share a little bit of me with each of you. And I hope that, you know, each of you take home a piece of my courage if you need it. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Annie. And our next speaker will be Karen from Saskatchewan, Canada.
Oh, how do you follow that? Good morning. My name is Karen, and I'm an alcoholic. I have notes because I tend to be a cut-up, and I might get carried away with some story, because a lot of funny things happened as well as sad things. I'm also a very grateful member of Al-Anon. My home group is the Sutherland group that meets Thursday night in Saskatoon, where I'm also the GSR for that group, and I cause a lot of controversy just by showing up. Thank you for the extraordinary honor and privilege of sharing my experience, strength, and hope with you this morning. I absolutely love Alcoholics Anonymous. I love it. I just love it. With the help of my higher power, whom I choose to call God, and the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, I have not had to take a drink of alcohol since May 5th, 1981. Thank you for being here for me. You've saved my life and the lives of my children. I am truly blessed and truly grateful. Thank you, Alcoholics Anonymous. Thank you. I'll tell you a little bit about what it was like, what happened, and what it's like today. I'm the oldest of three children. There's no alcoholism in my immediate family. My parents were good people who worked hard to provide for us. My father was an Irish businessman. My mother was a German-French Métis. I think that qualifies me. Catholic. And I had a very good upbringing. I went to school with Roman Catholic nuns who prized silence, obedience, and proper behavior. I took music lessons with nuns who expected perfection. I grew up in an era where children were to be seen and not heard. I never fit into any of these expectations. I learned very early in life that the way to win friends was to make people laugh, and neither my parents nor the nuns appreciated that skill. So I no longer blame my parents nor the nuns for the way my life turned out. I believe they did what they thought was best for me. But I can still feel the pain of being strapped by those nuns for talking, not listening to instructions, or once for cheating when I had simply picked up a pen and handed it to a classmate during a spelling test. I also remember the music nun pulling my earlobes until they cracked and sharply slapping my little knuckles with steel-edged rulers until I cried. And then they'd smile at me and coax me to smile. So I learned to smile through tears. If I told my parents, they would simply say, well, if you studied harder or practiced more, they wouldn't do that. So I'd get some sort of punishment at home. So I stopped telling them. Now I started keeping secrets and trying to cope as best I could on my own. With strict conforming parents, nuns, and Catholicism, I was expected to be a good girl. And I guess I was. I had my first drink of alcohol when I was 15, and I don't really remember much about the taste of it, except I loved the laughter, the music, and the fun that went along with drinking. From then on, I was attracted to the wild boys who always had alcohol and nice cars, and who, loved to party. I usually got drunk whenever I drank, and I often passed out. I thought everyone drank like I did. Fortunately, I grew up in a small town where I had good friends who always had my back, and nothing bad happened to me. When I graduated and started working, I had more freedom to party, and I took advantage of it. Every opportunity I had. I had lots of friends, and life was good. A couple of years later, a friend of mine was living in a city nearby, and she was going to university, and she asked me to come and move in with her. I decided to do this, and I came home from work one day. I had a good job, and she was asking me we should go to audition for go-go dancing. And I thought, well, I have a good job. I really don't need to do that. But she thought it would be a good way for us to meet men, to get more exposure. And so I said, well, I'll go along for company. Now, when we arrived at the disco, I was instantly aware of this gorgeous, dark-haired lead guitar player. And when the rock music started, they wanted to dance. So I asked the choreographer if I could dance without putting my name down for auditioning, and she said, no, if you want to dance, you have to put your name on the list. So I didn't think I stood a chance with all of the city girls here, so I put my name down. And in the first elimination, I was picked, and my roommate was not. And so I thought, well, this is kind of fun. I'm going to see where this takes me. And as it turned out, I was hired along with seven other young women to go-go dance, both at the disco and to travel with local rock bands. So we danced for some famous and not-so-famous rock bands, and we did meet some interesting men and many more not-so-interesting. And I continued to drink. Now, Marta didn't drink like I did, my roommate, and often she'd say, why do you drink so much? And I thought, well, I wonder why, but I never gave it much thought. I was having too much fun. And then that good-looking lead guitar player noticed me. I did everything I could to get his attention, of course. And Marta didn't like him either, and she said he drank too much. But in order to stay friends, I didn't quit drinking. Instead, I moved out, and I moved in with another girl, Heather, who drank like I did. Now, the guitar player and I fell in love, and 8 months later, I was pregnant. Gord was the second oldest of a family of 12, and he was excited to be a dad. I was horrified. How was I going to go back to this Catholicism and rules and so on and tell my parents I was pregnant? Now, when we told them, my mother nearly had a stroke, of course. First, she told me he wasn't the man for me, but then she told me to go back to the city and find a priest and plan a wedding. So my dad just wanted me to be happy. Now, I love this man, and I believe that once we were married and had our child, we would be happy. However, this was not to be, since I now found myself at home alone a lot while he continued to drink and play, literally, and without me. Although I had quit drinking when I was found out I was pregnant, I pleaded with him to take me along. I knew nothing about alcoholism, other than from the neighbor who lived across the street when I was a child. I remember watching him often fall out of his vehicle and crawl up to his house. I knew this was disgusting behavior by the look on my mother's face, and I thought it was, I learned it later, it was because he was drunk. And by the way, he died sober in Alcoholics Anonymous. But my lovely young husband didn't act like that. Now, how could he be alcoholic? I just wanted him to slow down or take me with him. We made several geographical cures, reconciliations, separations, and the last one long enough to have another child, a little girl. I was still not drinking. I was attending Al-Anon and working to support our family. Gord started going to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, and often I attended open meetings where alcoholics would share their stories. I began to suspect that my drinking as a teenager and young adult had certainly not been social drinking, always getting drunk, passing out, and usually relying on other people to take care of me. So I joined the New Life Ladies Alcoholics Anonymous group. I even got a sponsor, Molly. But I hadn't really suffered with my drinking, nor did I really understand just how cunning and baffling this disease can be. And although you had told me that even though I had stopped drinking for those few years, if I was truly alcoholic, the disease would still be progressing in me. I either didn't believe you or I didn't take it seriously enough. So I simply hung out. I went to a few meetings, enjoyed the fellowship and all the laughter and fun that we have. And I didn't work the steps. I didn't use the traditions in my life. And I certainly never asked a higher power to keep me sober or thank him for keeping me sober. I thought I was doing that on my own. My husband's alcoholism was also progressing, and we decided he would go to a treatment center. When I joined him there for his family week, his counselors told me I was not alcoholic or I would have kept drinking, pregnant or not, alone or not. And I've since learned that many alcoholic women quit drinking while pregnant. In any case, I filed that for future reference. And when my husband left that treatment facility and within 1 month went back drinking, we separated for the last time and divorced. Leaving him was one of the most painful things I've ever had to do in my life. I loved that man. I had two little kids, a four-year-old and a one-year-old. And I was scared to death. However, I owned my own home, I had a good paying job, I had self-respect, self-esteem, and the confidence that we could make it. I continued to go to Al-Anon, but AA only occasionally. Then someone gave me a bottle of wine for my birthday, I drank it, and nothing happened except that I stopped going to the Alcoholics Anonymous meetings and also associating with women from the ladies' group. Soon I was going out with the girls for drinks after work, and within a very short time I was back partying. Now, in addition to passing out, I was blacking out, and my life was spiraling out of control. I have to say that I terrorized my children with my neglect and absenteeism. I abused them in every way possible, and I regularly drove drunk with them. I could be lying on the couch, too tired and depressed to be interested in anything they had to say, only to have the phone ring with an invitation from someone with a bottle and a party, and I would spring into action, clean up, and be out the door in 15 minutes. It didn't matter that my five-year-old was screaming out over the balcony, "Don't go, Mommy." If I couldn't get a sitter, another mom would have stayed home, but not me. I either left my kids alone or I dragged them along with me. Sometimes I'd go to wherever and there would be no... I'd come to wherever and there'd be no sign of them. I couldn't remember where I'd left them or with whom. They would beg me to stay home. They were afraid. They knew their dad was gone because of his drinking, and now their mother was doing the same. Was she going to be gone too? Somewhere I met a man who claimed to have fallen in love with me. We were both in love with me, Scotch and country music. And he was the answer to prayer for a self-centered, selfish, alcoholic woman. We drank together and he kept my glass full of the best. We have been through a whole lot of hell together. We've had many separations and reconciliations. But this September we will celebrate 29 years of marriage. Coincidentally, the same length of time that I've been sober. Now, when I met this man, Cuneo, I was suffering from severe alcoholism. People can say that when you tell alcoholics are dating, there's a moving van in the driveway. And this was true for us. 2 weeks after we met, I loaded up my kids, a moving van with three floors of furniture, and moved in. Never mind that Trinio is Japanese from a totally different culture with centuries of tradition. I couldn't even pronounce his name. I knew nothing about this man, and he knew nothing about me. And he said that I introduced him to a joy of living he never knew existed. I don't know if he'd say the same thing today. Every time we'd have a fight, and we had lots of them, as you can imagine, I'd call a moving van. My children went to 10 schools in those 6 years, all in one city. They paid the price for my insanity. Finally, my kids and I are on our own again, and the insanity of drinking is continuing. This behavior doesn't go unnoticed by caring neighbors. Someone called child welfare, and they paid me a visit. My wide-eyed kids were sitting side by side on the couch while the worker drilled me for leaving them alone so much. With all the arrogance that only a sick, self-centered alcoholic can muster, I answered, "If you're going to take them, because I'm not going to change a damn thing." Then the worker asked me why I didn't get a nanny. I snapped back, and where is she supposed to sleep, in the knife drawer? Fortunately, the worker left, and my kids stayed with me. I should not have been allowed to keep them. I thank God that they were not taken away from me that day. They suffered with me, but they may have suffered more had they gone into foster care. It actually took me 5 years of sobriety in Alcoholics Anonymous to finally admit that whoever had reported me was caring about my kids, not jealous of me. Somewhere in this fog, I had started a consignment clothing business. Now I'm a businesswoman with an expense account, business cards, and alcoholism. One morning, I found myself laying on the top of a pile of consigned clothing, and as all alcoholics do, I had a moment of clarity. My life flashed before me as I lay there, and I came to the full realization that the counselors in the treatment center had been wrong. I was alcoholic. I knew I'd have to get back to Alcoholics Anonymous, but this thought had only stayed with me until noon, when I slipped back into denial and thought, "I'll be fine. I just need some rest. Too much stress." Furthermore, Cuneo and I had continued to see each other, and he was going on a sabbatical leave out of the country, and I knew that my drinking was out of control, and I could no longer guarantee my behavior if I took that first drink. And I knew that without him looking after me, I was going to get into serious trouble. But rather than go back to Alcoholics Anonymous, I decided I would drink at home alone. I would be safer. I wouldn't have to share my bottle with anyone. Truth was, I had few friends, and nobody wanted me around. It was like Bette Midler in the movie The Rose, where it's everybody going. As the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous says, alcohol had given me wings to fly, then taken away the sky. Where once alcohol had allowed me to be totally irresponsible and just have fun, I was now lonely, depressed, and suicidal. In fact, I was numb. I just didn't care anymore. I was like a wild woman. I was bleaching my hair. It was orange. I was as skinny as a 12-year-old. I was angry, and I spoke like a longshoreman. Finally, I had my last drunk in one of the finest dining establishments, and by the grace of God, a former co-worker was a witness. I ran into her a few days later, and she said, "But all alcoholics love to hear, boy, you sure look better than you did the other night." While I was trying to remember the other night and simultaneously hoping that I would not remember, she was happy to refresh my memory. I walked away from her filled with the nightmare of that memory and the terrible self-loathing that Bill writes about. Courage to change, the courage to change the things I can, the second line in that beautiful serenity prayer that we usually say before every meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous and Al-Anon. I was so full of fear I was nauseated when I finally picked up the phone a few days later to call Molly. What if she was angry? What if she told me to get lost? What if? Oh, and then she answered. I burst into tears, and I said, "Molly, I need help." And she simply and quietly answered, "Sounds like you need a meeting." I owe this woman my life. She was so patient, kind, loving, and tolerant with me. However, she did tell me in no uncertain terms that if she was going to sponsor me once again, I was going to do as I was told. I was going to attend home meetings faithfully, and if I missed a meeting, it better be because I had to attend a funeral, and it better be mine. I went back to the New Life Ladies group and those little white-haired women who I had left early, thinking they had nothing to teach me. Oh, it was so insulting. I was now willing to listen. I looked into their eyes, and I could see serenity and sincerity, and I wanted what they had. They were really happy, and I wanted what they had. When I sobered up, I had no problem admitting I was alcoholic and that my life was unmanageable. I had sold my house, quit my good-paying job, probably before being fired for absenteeism. I was living in subsidized housing and working part-time at a far less-paying job. I had lost all self-respect, all self-esteem, and I couldn't believe what had happened to my life or my confidence. And I didn't know my kids. The teachers were on my case. My 13-year-old son was depressed. He was falling asleep in school. My daughter, now 9, was smoking cigarettes and drinking beer with the neighbors. She was crawling in through neighbors' basement windows and helping herself to their food, even though we had food in our house. Both of my kids had been shoplifting. The police brought my daughter home one day, and she promptly told me her brother had shown her how to do it. And I also learned that my 13-year-old had been driving my car around the parking lot. I was convinced my kids would turn into delinquents, and I was terrified this thing wouldn't work for me. And the women in the ladies' group listening to me whining and complaining just kept saying, let go, honey. Because I had walked away from Catholicism with bitterness and resentment, I wasn't interested in the God thing. And Molly told me, just keep it simple. Just please keep me sober in the morning and thank you at night. She was helping me do my second and third step, to believe I could too could be restored to sanity, and to turn my will and my life over to the care of a higher power. Molly told me God's will for me was simply take good care of myself, to be a good mom for my kids, and do a good job for my employer. Just show up for duty. I argued with Molly about everything. I was so angry I would curse and swear while describing my miserable life. She would tell me to clean up my mouth or she was going to hang up. And I would yell, you're my sponsor, you have to listen to me. And she'd quietly say, no, I don't. And if you continue, I'm going to hang up. And I'd continue screaming, and she'd say, I'm going now, and she'd hang up. I'd be furious and throw the phone. But the next time, I'd speak appropriately. Molly kept reminding me that I was a sober woman in Alcoholics Anonymous, and this program is based on attraction, not promotion. She'd add that I'd be attracting no one with my mouth and my behavior. So with her encouragement, I found the courage to change that thing, too. There was nothing fearless about me when I started my step four, and Molly and I worked on it together, helped me to find assets as well as defects, and even made my fifth step appointment for me, the step which ends the isolation of alcoholism. Having grown up Catholic and confessing my sins, I didn't find it difficult to meet with a priest to do my fifth step, and right after that I asked my higher power to remove these character defects and shortcomings, but I was not allowed to rest. Molly knew I was a runner. She wasn't letting go. She told me to get busy with my eighth step, the list of people I'd harmed with my drinking. And now I started with myself, and I wrote pages. Next came my kids, my parents, and my siblings. And I'm glad Molly pushed me to do a step 9, making amends with my parents. My dad died suddenly, soon after, and my dad was very happy that I was straightening out. My 14-year-old son was very forgiving. My daughter, not so much, until much later. But they were both ecstatic to have their mom back. My siblings didn't believe I was alcoholic, and my mom wanted to blame herself. Their response was not my business. My business was only to make the amend. Now I needed to learn the maintenance steps. In step 10, taking daily inventory of what I've done right and what I've done wrong, and if wrong, promptly admitting it. Now I really needed courage to do this, and this was probably the most difficult step for me. Today I can still be quick to criticize or to get angry. But I'm also quick to realize when I'm wrong and I need to apologize. And the sooner I do, the easier my life becomes. In step 11, I learned to pray and meditate and asking my higher power for his will for me and the power to carry it out. Molly had suggested right from day one that I make it a habit upon awakening to say the third step prayer, the seventh step prayer, and the 11th step prayer of St. Francis of Assisi found in the 12 and 12. I now do these steps together on a daily basis and often several times a day. Molly and the other woman took me on many 12-step calls. These women were fearless, but they insisted that nothing bad ever happened when we were helping another alcoholic. We were often met by shotguns and German shepherds. Soon after I sobered up, I was also told to make a gratitude list, that there's always something to be grateful for. I remember complaining that sobriety was boring, like watching paint dry. And another AA member told me that someday sobriety was going to be exciting. I couldn't imagine. But I kept going to meetings, praying, talking to my sponsors, reading the big book, and gradually life started turning around. My kids began to trust me and believe me when I would tell them I'd be home from work. Their teachers got off my case. The police stopped visiting. Cuneo came home from sabbatical leave and we got married. We've stayed together through a lot of pain and upheaval. Cuneo didn't even get on my eight-step list until much later. But he has stayed right by my side through my recovery from alcoholism, helping me raise my kids, making it possible for me to get an education, and now we're entering another phase, retirement and aging, which is another exciting project that requires creativity as well as courage. When I lost my beloved Molly, first to illness and then to death, I became disillusioned with my home group. I stopped going to regular meetings. I didn't drink, but the anger and resentments returned. I started hating my life again and planning death and not mine. Again, my higher power intervened. Around the same time, he made it financially possible for me to purchase a lakeside cottage. I learned that one of my female friends in Alcoholics Anonymous also owned a cottage at the same lake. That was not a coincidence. After this woman annoyed me with a lecture of getting back to Alcoholics Anonymous regularly, we went to a meeting together. It was an 11-step meeting and a 40-year birthday. I felt like I'd come home. I asked this woman to be my sponsor. She is very involved in service, and she has a service sponsor. Through her encouragement, I too have become involved in service. I became group rep for my home group, and we attend assemblies together. Service has enhanced my spiritual, emotional, and physical sobriety and enriched my AA friendships. The experience has inspired me to stay involved with service. As I've been told, you let your name stand. If you don't get the position you'd like, your higher power will decide what position you need. Today I continue to attend 2 to 3 meetings a week, 2-step meetings and 1-topic meeting. I still have that wild child in me. And the committee continues to meet regularly in my head. And I need at least 3 meetings a week to just stay grounded and in my business, riding my own bicycle. I maintain regular communication with my sponsors, and I sponsor several women who are also maintaining their sobriety one day at a time. We are learning the steps together, and I am learning a lot about courage from these women. Neither my son nor my daughter have alcoholism. They are both happily married. They are successful and have children of their own, a miracle of Alcoholics Anonymous. They are good parents. Because I had the courage to make that phone call to Molly early enough in their childhood and allowed the women in the ladies' group and other members of Alcoholics Anonymous to teach me how to be a mom, I was able to make amends with my kids, and I continued to maintain healthy relationships with them. Best of all, they both trust me enough to let me spend time alone with their children, my darling grandchildren, the greatest gift of sobriety, and for this I'm truly grateful. To conclude, after step 9 and before step 10 are the promises. If we are painstaking, we will suddenly realize that God is doing for us what we could not do for ourselves. With sobriety became a university education. When I was filled with fear about some class or exam, or I heard the tapes of the teachers calling me wool gatherer and throwing blackboard brushes at me, I borrowed your courage. 5 years later, I graduated with a double honors BA in sociology, and 6 years after that, a master's in criminology. I even volunteered with the local police service as a victim support worker for 7 years while I went to school. Unfortunately, when I went back to my hometown to brag about some of my former teachers about my achievements, most of them had Alzheimer's. I shouldn't have waited so long. Another gift of sobriety is international travel. My husband travels all over the world in his career, and I often get to accompany him. I had an incredible fear of flying, which I tackled with prescription pills instead of courage, but then the pills became a problem. So I finally found the courage to confront that fear too, and today I can fly clean and sober. As I look back over where the disease of alcoholism has taken me and how it's affected my life, I am reminded that I've often said the Serenity Prayer. My 3-year-old would go through the house, "Oh God, grant me the serenity." I have repeatedly asked for the courage to change, and my prayers have been answered in spite of myself. With answer to prayer has come a deeper faith and a lessening of fear. I know that no matter what lies ahead, as long as I stay with you and I continue to let go and let God, on a daily basis, I will be okay. Thank you for my sobriety. Thank you for listening, and God bless you in your recovery.
That was quite a story. Thank you. And for our last speaker, Renee from Maryland.
Hello, everyone. My name is Renee, and I'm from Area 13, and I'm an alcoholic. My home group is the Landover Group. My anniversary date is October 17th, 1999. And as Ann spoke before, I'm here really to explain how I became courage, had courage today to change my life. It made me a new person. And Ann mentioned that the quality, the courage, the definition of courage was the quality of mind or spirit, enabling one to meet danger or opposition with fearlessness. Now, I thought I had courage, and I thought I was very tough, even when I started elementary school. Because in kindergarten, I went to school, and my mother, on my first day, put a nice flannel new shirt on me. And a kid in the class ripped my flannel shirt, the pocket. I went back to my father, and my father told me, he said, "Son, you have to fight your own battles." And so I did. My sisters and brothers, my younger ones, kids bothered them at school, and my father said, "Son, you have to take care of your younger brothers and sisters." So I did. Before you know it, I was a leader of a gang in that elementary school. And we used to take kids' lunch money and lunches. Now, taking those lunches was very a good delicacy because for my mother, she would make jelly on a sandwich so thin that the bread would absorb all the jelly. And man, wasn't those other people's lunches a lot better? My mother had seven beside myself, and that's eight. So you can imagine. Now, one day, one of the kids told their parents that I was taking their lunch. That parent chased me all the way home. So I dashed and ran home, ran up the steps, ran into my father's bedroom, got behind the bedroom door, and back behind that bedroom door was homemade wine, a lot of jugs. And I sat between them, and I saw one jug, and I pulled it up to my mouth, and I could still feel those burning peaches going down my throat. Wow, I didn't fear no one chasing me anymore. But one thing, that was my first drink at the age of six. Now, alcohol continued in my life, and of course, disaster started afterwards, different disasters. In junior high school, one day I was coming from a part-time job, and I went into an area where another gang was, and I got shot in the eye, my left eye, and lost my sight. And the first thing I did was blame God. And I went and said, "I'm going to do things on my own because, God, you did not help me. You made me lose the sight of my left eye." And I blamed God all my life until I got back into this program. But as time went on, alcohol did become my friend because what happened was, whenever I took a drink, it seemed like it just gave me this kind of courage. You know, like when people were bigger and I was in the gang, they seemed smaller. When women were around and I was shy, I could always ask them to dance. I could ask them to go out. Or I could even sing to them. You know how that is. But as time went on, when I reached the age of 30, I ended up with over 10 DWIs. And one day, I was coming out of a bar, and I got into my car. Now, normally, when I'm drinking, the car seems to just drive in the middle of the road on its own pretty well. But just this happened, this particular night, the car just veered off on its own and crashed in three others and mine and just totaled them. And right then, that same night, I thought about one of those DWIs. When the judge told me, said, Renee, the next time you come before me, I'm going to put you under the jail. So I said, I ran to my wife and I told her, I said, you know what? I need to go to that AAA thing. She says, Renee, it's not AAA, it's AA. So she found a rehab for me. The program in the rehab, particularly this one, said you have to have a sponsor when you leave. Well, my idea of a sponsor, you know me, I thought he was going to try to get me my car back. Give me a new one anyway, or somehow. But what he ended up doing was taking me to a lot of meetings with a lot of other alcoholics, and they were all in there smelling like alcohol. And I said, the first chance I get when I get my car, I'm going to stop going with this guy. And so that's what happened. I got my car, and before you know it, I started sponsoring myself. And I ended up back out there with the same people, same gang, doing the same idiotic things. And as I did, I noticed that eventually my life was getting a little worse. What's happening was alcohol began to control my life. It began to control my job. And also I began to see my family less and less. This continually kept happening, and things got worse. What happened was, after that one time when I went back, I ended up really, as alcohol really got bad, I ended up with no money, no family, and all alone. And the ladies of the night was ended up doing what they had to do for me to give me my drink and finding me a place to stay. At this time, one day, I sat back and I said, God, what has happened to me? Can someone please help me? And at that time, I went home and asked my wife where I have left for so many years. And I asked her, I said, I could not stop drinking. Can you help me? And she asked me, she got me a place in Florida, but we didn't have any money for me to go. And what ended up was, thank God, God came into my grace. She told me to ask my mother-in-law, my mother-in-law came up with the plane fare for me to go down to Florida to this rehab. And when I went down to Florida, that was October the 16th, 1999, that was my last drink. I was drinking on my way on that plane. But when I got into that program, it was only God's good grace that I got there. I found out in that program we had good counseling. But I also found out that the first question I asked when I got down there was, what happened to this tough guy? What happened to all the courage I was getting from the bottle that I thought I was? But also when I was down in Florida, I found out one thing. When I read part in the big book where it says that fear is the corroding thread, the fabric of our lives are shot through with it. I found out that I was afraid. I didn't have courage. It was false courage. It was a myth. That fear that I had, it was fear before I drank, fear why I drank, and the fear was still there after I drank. It was false courage. So when I was down in the rehab and we were about to leave, they were supposed to put me in a halfway house. But when I got to the halfway house, it wasn't about stop drinking. They were doing other things and things were going on. So I asked to come back to my area, to my family. And that was a great thing coming back to Maryland, because when I got back to Maryland, I found my second sponsor. And that's when I began to start to find the courage. The first thing that sponsor told me, he said, "Renee, you've been in and out of this program. He says, you need to get into the steps and do some service work." And he took me to my first meeting, which is my home group, and he told me to make coffee. And even though I've had many AA positions, I'm still making coffee. You know, it's the first thing he also got me was, when he got me into the steps, was he showed me that we were powerless over alcohol, that I didn't have to do this thing alone. He also told me that you knew your life was unmanned any time the ladies of the night is doing what they had to do to give you a drink and a place to stay. And he also told me to read the book on the doctor's opinion, because he think if I read it good enough, I can identify. And I love that part because, you know, that we have an allergy and that our bodies is abnormal as our minds. That point brought out a lot to me, because I really didn't think alcohol was that much of a disease, nor did I think that anything else was more powerful than me. When I got to step two, I had to use the group, because I told him I did not believe in God. God took my love by sight. So he said, keep coming back. Use the group as your higher power. I did that, and I listened to all of your stories. And by listening to your stories, I became aware that I had a higher power that was God. And that God was carrying me all the time. Because I didn't realize all the time that I was sitting up there, didn't even realize that he gave me back my sight, my left eye, which was a gift. I've been drinking so long and running around with so much fear, I didn't even realize it. Step three, he said, we're going to go on with these steps. When I got to step four, you know, writing my inventory was the greatest thing. I didn't even know about, you know, character defects, anger. I had them all the time, but snapping at other people and hurting other people, but never knew it was a part of a character defect. And I found out that I was really a self-centered person. I wanted everything my way, or you take the highway. And I always blamed everybody for my problems. I didn't do it. You were the cause of it. And I think when I got the fifth step, I had to build up a lot of courage to tell someone my story. And then, when my sponsor told us, after I told him my story, I felt relieved. But then when we said that prayer to the God I didn't believe in, and then I started believing, because I felt so wonderful that day when I went home. The sixth and seventh was the best courage I ever had. And that's to turn all my character defects over to God, a person that I thought was never with me but was carrying me the whole time. And to take care of those shortcomings, because I'm not perfect. Thank God for that. I always thought I was. And then, if you really think about it, when we come to change, transformation into something else. When I got to 8, 9, making my amends, I began to change. And then when I got to step 10 says, we cease fighting anyone, even alcohol. And by that time, sanity will have returned. That was great for me. And that's where things began to look. I wasn't now fighting, blaming everyone. You know, I was doing my inventory on a daily basis. And when my shortcomings do pop up, because I'm not perfect, I use my step 11, take a pause, and use a prayer that's even in the big book, or some of those prayers that in some other religious books that Bill said we can do now. You know, it's amazing. But when I got to step 12, freely giving back what's been freely passed on to me was the best thing that ever happened to me. Service work. And my sponsor, I'm so glad he put me into service work right away. And passing it on with no strings attached. Because when I was out there, especially in the gangs, I always thought you owe me if I gave you something. But like Bob, Dr. Bob said, the four reasons why he passes it on was number one, it's a sense of duty. Number two, it's a pleasure. Number three, it's a debt to the sponsor that passed it on to him. And number four is to protect himself for a possible slip. I think the same way Dr. Bob did. Those last steps created me and helped me to change. Without my higher power in AA, I wouldn't have never been able to have the courage to change the things I could and the wisdom to know the difference. For that, I am so grateful. What about you? Are you glad or grateful to have AA give you the courage to change your life around? Thank you.